Have you ever found that whenever you speak to people about the Lord Jesus, or maybe whenever people hear a sermon preached about the Lord Jesus, there are always a wide range of different responses? There are some perhaps who don't even listen to maybe what you're trying to say. There are some people perhaps who listen and understand, but don't really want to have to deal with the truth of what they hear. There are some people perhaps who don't really care about the truth of what they hear. They just want to do whatever's popular, whatever seems best to them at the time. There are some people, of course, who will just mock and laugh. And we trust there will be some people who will take the message seriously and start to consider for themselves what they might say about Jesus. That's the world in which we live, isn't it? All kinds of different responses to the gospel whenever it's shared. I've got good news for you this evening, and the good news is this, that variety of different responses is nothing new. It's not a sign that somehow we live in a more difficult age than any other age that's gone before. It's a sign, actually, that human beings right throughout the ages have responded in much the same ways to the same truths that's heard. And right throughout the entire history of the church, there have been some who've refused to listen. There have been others who have mocked. There's been some who've refused to understand. Others who've refused to act, even when they do understand. And we thank God that right throughout the whole of church history, there have also been men and women and boys and girls who have bowed the knee to Jesus. And what we're going to see as we explore together Mark chapter 15 in those first 20 verses is we're going to see a whole range of responses, not to preaching of Jesus now, but to Jesus himself. Because we discover as we do that, that the problem, therefore, is not necessarily in the way that we communicate about Jesus. It's not that somehow maybe we need to change what we say in order that people might listen or might stop mocking. That's not the problem. The problem, in a sense, is not what we say. If we can put it like this, and I hope you understand what I mean by this, the problem is Jesus himself. Or at least, the problem is how people respond to Jesus himself. Because as we go through this passage together and we look at the people who were here, when we look at the high priest, when we look at Pontius Pilate, when we look at the crowd, when we look at the soldiers, we'll find exactly the same responses in them that maybe we find in contemporary clinic today. So let's look at those people together, shall we? And you'll see as we go through those responses, just as I've said. Let's look first of all at the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah. The priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah. You see, at the beginning of this chapter, as we read it, Mark is summarizing the previous night's proceedings. Jesus has been arrested. He's been brought before the Sanhedrin. That's a ruling council of Jewish religious leaders. Remember at the time that Jerusalem and Judea had been was being ruled by the Roman Empire. So the Jews didn't have any political power, but they still did control the temple, and they had a great deal of religious power. So the Jewish leaders then are led really mostly by the chief priests and some others as part of this Sanhedrin, this Jewish ruling council. Very probably, if you can sort of imagine it in your mind's eye, different members of the council, there were 70 or so as far as we're able to tell, had probably been arriving through the night. It doesn't seem a particularly well-planned arrest, did it? It wasn't something that they had a date in their calendar. We'll make sure that on this day we'll get Jesus arrested. It all happened rather last minute when Judas betrayed Jesus. So very probably through the night, word was getting round and different people were arriving, all in order to hear Jesus' trial and to make their judgment. Except, well, actually, there wasn't going really to be a trial in the Jewish Sanhedrin that morning. It was just a consultation, as you can see. They're just going to rubber stamp the illegal trial that was held in the night before. And all they're going to do that morning is to change the charge against the Lord Jesus. You see, the night before, the charge against Jesus was blasphemy. You can see that particularly in verse 64 of the previous chapter, chapter 14, where the high priest tears his clothes and says, "You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. That was the charge, blasphemy, that he had the audacity to claim that the Old Testament promises about the coming Messiah were going to be and were fulfilled in him. The problem is they need to now get him to a Roman court, and the Romans, they don't really care about blasphemy at all. They're not interested in blasphemy. That's a religious problem. It's not a political problem. So they change the charge. And you can see that by the time they deliver him to Pilate in verse 2, the charge has changed from one of blasphemy to one of claiming to be the king of the Jews. Now it's a political crime that Jesus has apparently committed. And if the Romans aren't really caring about who claims to be the Messiah or who claims to be the Christ, the Son of God, they don't really care about that. They certainly do care about somebody who might claim to be king, who might claim to be emperor, who might claim the Roman throne. They really do care about that. And that's what they do. They send him to Pilate, having already found him guilty. They know his claims. They know when he claims to be king, he's not claiming to be earthly king. They know that Pilate's got nothing to fear, and nor has the Roman emperor. They know that. They know Jesus' claims are religious claims. They know that he's claiming effectively to be the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. They know that. And not only do they know that, but as you already know, throughout all of the Gospels, the chief priests have been following Jesus around, haven't they? They've seen what he's done. They've heard his teaching. They've heard him teach from the Bible, from the Old Testament. They've seen him work miracles. They've never seen him do anything wrong, ever. They've not had anyone honestly say a bad word against him that's true. They've seen as much as anyone. In many ways, they've seen more than you or I. And of course, they've got their own Bible knowledge, you would hope, that these religious leaders would know the Old Testament promises and prophecies about the coming Messiah. They can look it up. Your average Judean in the street wouldn't be able to go, and when Jesus claims perhaps to have fulfilled a certain prophecy, your average Judean wouldn't be able to go and look that up and make sure that Jesus is quoting it properly and it's really as it said. They wouldn't have the access to the text to do that. They may not be able to read, even if they did have access. But these people can. They can check it all out. They can look for themselves. They've got all the evidence, and they've got the ability and the opportunity to find even more evidence, to search the scriptures for themselves. But they don't do that. They choose not to do that. And we find out a little later in verse 10 of chapter 15 why that is. For he knew that the chief priests had handed Jesus over because of envy. Envy. He was more popular than they. People were following him instead of them. They were worried they would lose their power. And because of that, these chief priests refused to recognize the Messiah. They had all of the facts. They had all of the experience. They had all of the knowledge, they had all of the opportunity, and they refused. There's no other word we can use. They refused to recognize the Messiah. I wonder if you know people who are like the priests. Maybe you yourself is like one of the priests, or you were like one of the priests, blind to the gospel because you've closed your eyes to the truth. It's not that you've never heard. It's not that you don't understand. It's that you refuse, point blank, to possibly admit that you've got it wrong and you're on the wrong footing and that really you need to start all over again. And you might say to yourself, in your mind's eye, you might say to yourself, I've got too much to lose. That's what these people no doubt would have said. If all that Jesus has said is true, then there's no future for us. We're going to lose our positions of authority. We're going to lose our power. We'll lose our wealth. We'll lose our prestige. We've got too much to lose. We refuse, therefore, to recognize this one for who he claims to be. People who refuse to recognize the Messiah. Maybe that's you. Maybe you've got friends, family members who are like that. They've got their own lifestyle, a lifestyle that they're very happy with perhaps, but a lifestyle that is counter to the gospel message. And as they consider the gospel message, they realize that the truth claims of Jesus, and they say to themselves, well, if this is true, then everything's got to change for me. And it's too much to lose. I refuse then to recognize Jesus for who it is. It's not that they refuse to believe in him. These priests believed in Jesus, didn't they? They believed he existed. They believed who he was, who he claimed to be. They believed he died on the cross in a few days' time. They believed all that. But they wouldn't bow the knee to him. They wouldn't recognize that he was Lord. And so many people today are just the same, refusing to recognize Jesus as Messiah for fear that it would change their life. Well, those are the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah, but we need to move on now to the ruler who refuses to take responsibility. The ruler who refuses to take responsibility. I'm thinking now, of course, of Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor or prefect. Now, this Roman governor, Pilate, as we've said, he was the political appointee appointed by the emperor in Rome to make sure that the Judean province was kept in order, that there were no great riots, that the taxes came back to Rome. That was basically his job. He'd set up local councils and magistrates and so on in order to keep the peace, and on occasion, for big crimes or big trials, he might make a judgment himself. There wasn't, of course, a judicial system in the way that we would have today. There weren't judges who were appointed and would sit in various courts. It was all a bit more ad hoc. There wasn't anything like the Crown Prosecution Service who would bring charges. Most of the charges would be private prosecutions. So how did this end up on Pilate's plate? Well, it ended up on Pilate's plate because of the type of crime that Jesus was accused of. Remember, he was accused of being king of the Jews. And that crime, if that's true, if that's what Jesus really has done, if it's trying to usurp the throne, then that's a crime that carries the death penalty. And that's now, therefore, needs to come to Pilate, who on behalf of the Roman Empire can give that death sentence. It's what the chief priest wants. Now, Jesus didn't really have much in the way of judicial rights. He wasn't a Roman citizen, and those rights of justice applied only to Roman citizens. And as a consequence, then, he really was at the whim of Pilate. If Pilate had got out of the bed on a good side, then maybe he would get off. If Pilate had got out of bed on the wrong side, maybe he wouldn't. That's how justice sadly worked often in Jesus' day. So what happens to Pilate here? Well, we're told very clearly, aren't we, that Pilate knows the truth. He understands what's going on. He's not a fool. He's not hoodwinked by the chief priests to pass this judgment against his better instincts. He's not hoodwinked. He understands what's going on. Do you remember I read earlier about the chief priests handed Jesus over because of envy? That wasn't Mark's opinion that he wrote in his gospel. That was Pilate's opinion that Mark records. And if we go down to verse 14 of chapter 15, we read there that Pilate asks these chief priests, what evil has he done? What evil has he done? He asked the crowd, what evil has he done? He understands this man has done nothing wrong. The other gospel writers make that even clearer. And just like today, the court is open. So this crowd has gathered by this stage, whipped up, of course, by the chief priests. He doesn't want to be caught out in front of this great crowd, perhaps, of not asking the right questions. He certainly doesn't want to be bounced into making a decision just because the chief priests tell him to. There's always a bit of a power struggle between Pilate and the religious leaders. He may well want to deny them what they're asking for in order to assert his own political power over them. That seems to be how his mind is set, at least at the moment. Now, some people have sympathy with Pontius Pilate. The Greek Orthodox Church even made Pontius Pilate a saint. Mark doesn't have a great deal of sympathy for Pontius Pilate. I'm afraid I don't either. Because ultimately, he's a crowd pleaser, isn't he? You can see it very clearly in verse 15. We're told it explicitly by Mark. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, releases this man Barabbas, we'll come to him later, and condemns Jesus. He's a crowd pleaser. He's a populist. He fears man rather than God. And he doesn't take responsibility. He's famous for that, isn't he, Pontius Pilate, that he washes his hands of the guilt of Jesus. Except, of course, he can't do that, can he? He can't wash his hands of Jesus. And nor can you, and nor can I. At the moment, Pontius Pilate is the judge. But there is a day, of course, when Pontius Pilate will have to face the judge. And on that day, he will have not been able to have washed his hands of his verdict. He won't be able to blame anyone else. He won't be able to point the finger. He, on that day, will be forced to take responsibility. But here, he's refusing to do that. He wanted to let Jesus go, but he wasn't prepared to act. He sees no harm in Jesus, but at the same time, perhaps he sees little value in Jesus. What good is it going to do him if he lets Jesus go? It's not going to win him any favors with the chief priests. It apparently is not going to win him any favors with the crowd. There's nothing to gain for Pilate. Well, in that case, he might as well be killed. But that's not my responsibility, Pilate says. It's the Jews who have brought him here. It's the crowd who have shouted, "Crucify him," on their heads be it. Again, I know a lot of people like Pontius Pilate. Maybe you do too. Maybe you are a Pontius Pilate or were. Somebody, in other words, who, whatever the evidence and whatever happens, refuses to take responsibility for your actions. And people like that are blind to the gospel, as blind as the chief priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah. Blind to the gospel, because if you can't recognize your own failings or sin, you'll never see that you need the gospel. And that was part of Pilate's problem. It's part of the problem of many that I know today. It was part of my problem many years ago. Everything was everybody else's fault. When I was a little boy, my sister who made me do it. It always is, isn't it? You'd point the finger, you'd blame somebody else. But we still do it as adults. We're a little bit more sophisticated than we were as children. We don't want to be caught out in quite the same way as pointing the finger. But we'll certainly say things like, "She made me angry." Did she? Did he? Or did you become angry after something she did? No, we become angry ourselves. There may be provocation, certainly. We don't have to become angry. We might say, "She led me on." All around, we see people refusing to take responsibility for their actions. Nowadays, of course, you'll find children doing this. We've been taught, quite rightly, that parents and our upbringing can have a huge influence on children, quite right. The children know that too. I think I've told you the story before of being on a camp and trying to stop a fight about to happen. And the child that I was literally physically preventing from hitting another child said, and I quote, "It's not my fault. I've got anger management issues." Someone had told him that, I don't think particularly helpfully. It's never our fault. Do you know what it is to think that way? Refusing to take responsibility for your actions. And many of your friends, perhaps, who you try and talk to about Jesus, just won't see the need of Jesus because they won't see their sin, because everything is someone else's fault. It's very hard, isn't it, to get through that? Because it seems the only way you can get through that is to point out their sin, which of course won't make you a very popular person and may not be wise. Perhaps we can talk about our own sin and our own sense of guilt, and maybe that might help the person to understand. But I know many Pontius Pilates blind to the gospel because they won't recognize their own failings or sin. We've seen the chief priests, we've seen the ruler. It's now turned for the time for the crowd. The crowd, you see, refuse to release the innocent. The crowd refuses to release the innocent. Why do they do that? It's hard, isn't it, to get to the motivation of the crowd. What does the crowd want? What are they trying to achieve? Why would they want Barabbas released to them rather than Jesus? After all, Jesus has been a very popular figure. He's gone around doing good, hasn't he? He's healed people. Thousands have flocked to him to hear his teaching and for him to work miracles. Why then would suddenly the crowd turn on him and choose instead a murderer in a rebellion, verse 7, which is what Barabbas was? Well, we get part of the answer, perhaps, in verse 11 of chapter 15, that the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he should rather release Barabbas to them. They were influenced, they were led, perhaps, by those rulers. Foolish, certainly. But maybe actually they were wanting something grand. Maybe actually they had more sympathy with Barabbas than they did with Jesus. Maybe on that day in front of the Roman ruler, Pontius Pilate, they wanted to shake their fist at the Romans, as it were. And this one who has committed murder and who has been part of a rebellion, can be seen perhaps as almost a kind of Robin Hood-type figure who takes the fight to the enemy. Maybe the person he murdered was a Roman centurion or a Roman soldier. Maybe that's what happened. And maybe he was someone who was standing up for the Jews against these Roman oppressors. Perhaps the populist in all of them loved that kind of thing. Whereas Jesus, what's he ever done for us? Yeah, his teaching is something special, and yes, certainly he's healed some people, but he's never done anything for me, they might have said. He's not going to help us to shake off the yoke of the Romans. That's not his style. And that's our biggest need, they might have said. We need to get rid of the Romans. We need to drive them out. We need someone who can stand up for himself. And this Jesus, he's a wimp, they might say. We thought more of him, but he's just stood there. He's not resisted. He's almost a collaborator, you can hear some of them saying, perhaps the chief priest stirring them up. No, they choose the one who resists through murder and mayhem rather than the one who refuses violence. And there's a great irony here, of course, because as the crowd choose Barabbas, the violent rebel, they choose a path for themselves which will end in disaster. All of this is happening around about 30 AD or so, roughly. By 70 AD, there's been a huge great rebellion against the Romans in Jerusalem. They've taken up arms against the Romans. The Romans have to send in soldiers from other countries in order to try and quell. They set a siege around Jerusalem. That's after the soldiers having to recapture Galilee in the north and so on. And eventually, such is the strength of the Roman army against these rebels that Jerusalem itself is destroyed, the temple with it. They wanted rebellion, and they got it, and it killed them. The chief priests, you see, they thought that Jesus was a challenge to the temple, And he was. So they thought they'd kill him and let this Barabbas go. How did the temple fall? Through people like Barabbas, ultimately. And in so doing, fulfilled all of Jesus' prophecies. You see, as they chose Barabbas, this crowd, maybe it was a poke in the eye to Pilate. Perhaps they can see gain for themselves. Maybe if they can stand up, they'll have lesser taxes or whatever they may be. Maybe they find the message of violence easier to understand than the message of peace. But this crowd, you see, refuses to release the innocent. And they make the wrong choice. They're perhaps looking for the right things, but looking for a wrong choice. They're perhaps looking for salvation, perhaps looking for someone to rescue them, but they choose the wrong side. And again, I know many people in the crowd. Maybe you are one. Maybe you were one. Someone who doesn't think too deeply. Someone who's easily influenced by those who would stir up opinion. Someone who reads the gossip magazines and takes in everything that you read on Facebook. And you believe, maybe, therefore, or your friends believe, that science has disproved the Bible. That there are authentic gospels that tell a very different story about Jesus to these. Because that's what the power brokers have put in their minds. And the crowd doesn't think for itself, doesn't find out that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands probably of scientists around the world who have put their faith in Jesus Christ, doesn't understand that the gospels that we have in our Bible go back to the very first century, just a few decades after Jesus lived and died. That we have little fragments of those manuscripts in museums and in universities around the world, and that the so-called other gospels date to the second or third century, and there's no real way to authenticate them. Just go along with what other people think. It's the easy option to be popular and to take the popular view. And in so doing, of course, so many people are blind to the gospel because they do, well, what they're not even thinking about. They just go along with the others. And there's no salvation there. You see, this is the great irony to our time. There are thousands of people who are always looking for the next answer, the next thing that will make them happy. And they believe the adverts. And they buy the next thing, or they go on the next holiday, whatever it may be. This experience, this purchase will make me happy. That's what the advertisers say. But it's not, of course, and it doesn't work. And there's more grief and there's more sorrow. And just like for Jerusalem, it will end in tears, because the emptiness will always be there. Moving more quickly now, we've seen the priests, we've seen the ruler, we've seen the crowd. It's time now to look at the soldiers who refuse to take Christ seriously. The soldiers who refuse to take Christ seriously. We read about those in verses 16 to 20. We can see that they lead Jesus away and they gather together the whole garrison. This is something that everybody's going to enjoy. Let's get the crowd in to witness beating up this Jesus who was so popular. Let's show how strong and tough we are. So they make a mockery of Jesus. They clothe him with purple. That's the sign of royalty. They make a crown for him, but of course not of gold, but of thorns. And they put it on his head and they pretend to worship him. Hail, King of the Jews. They strike him on the head. We know from the other gospels that they blindfolded him first and then demanded that he prophesy who had hit them. They mocked him, in other words. They refused to take him seriously. And this whole company of soldiers, the whole garrison, perhaps 600 men, join in this mockery. Demonstrates, doesn't it, the wickedness of evil men. Demonstrates the mob mentality that can sometimes get hold. And it shows that Jesus is not like any king they have ever known, of course. Because they know that Jesus has no army. They know Jesus has no palace. They know that he rules no land. They know all that. And of course, because they know all that, they believe he cannot be a king. He cannot be taken seriously, this one who makes such outlandish claims. What other king would put himself last? What other king would take the role of a slave? What other king would willingly suffer death on behalf of his subjects? What other king would do that? No other king would do that. And because this king is like no other king, he's to be mocked and ridiculed. That's what the soldiers think. And I know many soldiers. People who've understood enough of the gospel to know that Jesus is not like anyone else who has ever lived. But precisely because he's not like anyone else who ever lived, they mocked him. You see, they know that nobody else has risen from the dead. Jesus claims to rise from the dead, so what do? Instead of thinking, here is a man who is utterly unique and unlike anyone else in all the world, and maybe I should worship him, they mock him. No one else claims to have stepped down from heaven to earth. But instead of taking that seriously and considering the implications of the God-man here on planet earth, they mock him, and they mock those who believe in the virgin birth. You see, blind to the gospel. And blind to the gospel not because they're clever. Blind to the gospel because they're fools. Blind to the gospel because they simply won't take seriously the claims of Jesus Christ. I'm not suggesting we should be gullible, but I am suggesting there is something different and something special about Jesus. There's something different about Jesus that means you can't just treat him in the way that you treat everybody else. These are claims that warrant careful investigation. These are claims worth pursuing. These are claims worth thinking about. But with the mob mentality and when people cheer you on, when you make fun of Christians, then people like Richard Dawkins or whoever just won't think. So we've seen all of these characters in this section. There's one, of course, who we haven't seen yet. One who almost we haven't heard from yet. We've seen the priests, we've seen the ruler, we've seen the crowd, we've seen the soldiers. Finally now we have the innocent one who refuses to defend himself. The innocent one who refuses to defend himself. Because apart from just a few words in verse 2, the one who is at the center of the drama, the one who matters more than anybody else in this section, is silent and almost invisible. Everybody else draws attention to themselves. Everybody else is shouting and screaming. But not Jesus. He stands alone, separate, different. And the whole narrative describes what is done to Jesus, not what he does. But even in the midst of this passivity, even in the midst of what seems like powerlessness, it is Jesus who chooses not to exercise that power. He could, of course, call down a whole legion of angels to take up arms against Rome and the entire Roman Empire. He could do that, but he chooses not to. He could bring the weight of heaven against those who mock him. He chooses not to do that. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Why is this? It is because what is happening here hasn't been planned by the chief priests, and it hasn't been planned by Pontius Pilate, and it wasn't planned by the crowd, and it wasn't planned by the soldiers. No, the only one who planned this was God himself. He's orchestrated it. He's made it happen. And Jesus' mission over these last 30 years has all been leading to this one point, where the nails will be driven to his hands, where he will be hoisted up on the cross, and where the weight of sin of the whole world
will be on his shoulders. And here at this moment, before those nails are put into his hands and his feet, we get a glimpse of what all this is about. We get a glimpse of it in chapter 15 and verse 15, where we see Barabbas's back as he walks away from Pilate's court and into the crowd. Because there is a guilty one. There is a murderer. And there is a rebel. And the murderer and the rebel go free, whilst the innocent one and the silent one takes the punishment that he deserves. You see, everyone in this story has abandoned and rejected Jesus. They're all guilty. The priests are guilty, Pilate's guilty, the crowd are guilty, the soldiers are guilty, the Jews and the Romans, the men and the women, the young and the old, they're all guilty. And us? Well, we, of course, too, are the priests who failed to recognize Jesus as king, didn't we, for much of our lives, maybe some of us for all of our lives. We are Pilate, who refused to take responsibility for our actions. We're the crowd who does what is popular rather than what is good. We're the soldiers who refuse to take Jesus' claim seriously. We're Barabbas, who deserves to be killed. And Jesus, who is he? Well, to me and to many, he's the Savior who died in my place. He's the one who took the punishment that I deserve. He's the one that allowed this guilty one to go free. That's who Mark presents him as. But who is he to you? Who is this Jesus? Are you still making the mistakes that the priest and the pilot and the crowd and the soldiers make? Are you like Barabbas, who walks away not realizing Jesus is willing to step into your place? Why don't you learn from their mistakes? Put your faith and trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, that he might be the one who rescues and redeems you, and you might be the guilty one who goes free.